acknowledge that we meet and work on what always was and always will be the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, as well as to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the wider community. Indigenous sovereignty has never been ceded in this country, and we try to be mindful of this in everything we do. Ancient Greeks had a word for people who enjoyed the connectivity of the outdoors: shoeless, begging, cajoling at strangers, offering and seeking love and agreement with nature, in full sight, crying out to whoever would listen. These people are not, as we might consider them now, through our neoliberal lens, as homeless. They were openly, consciously objecting citizens who decided the way towards enlightenment and revolution was to reject the interplay of work, labour, hierarchy, domination, role, and identity. Structures which we might call civilised social graces were perceived by these beings of reason and intuition as unnecessary impediments to virtue and an assonant life with other beings, human and non-human. Theirs was an ethical path that did not shun society, but rather lived in full view of all, displaying its philosophy for all to see, whilst daring to expose the pretensions which lay at the root of everyday conventions. They were called cynics. We still know their name now, unfortunately though, only in its negative sense, a disbelief in the goodness of human actions. I think that this definition can be rerouted to encompass the offering that the cynic held to humanity, a notion of the world citizen, the cosmopolitan, who, unencumbered by possessions or the need for wealth, fame, etc., could bring forward a human flourishing dependent on equanimity, ethics, love of humanity, speaking truth to power, and an indifference to the vicissitudes of life. It is time to reclaim the term, to describe people who question the accepted knowns of power structures that appear neutral and natural, but that are in fact very far from it. Most of these power structures, nation-states, banks, transnational corporations, militaries, data metric companies, media monopolies, are all carefully constructed entities with varying agendas that lead to similar results. A few gain or retain wealth, access, status and privilege. The many do not have this, and many are used to serve these ends for the few who gain. 83 people own more wealth than 3.6 billion people. I don't intend on showering this talk with statistics and figures. They are best not used when people cannot fact-check. And I am not a statistician, nor do I use quantitative measures to prove or disprove a point. But the discrepancy between the richest and the rest is, as we in this room would all agree, not only ridiculous, but at times deadly. Post-Marxist political philosopher Michael Hart purports that these kynikos, cynics, may be our postmodern day artist equivalent. In a world which has essentially outvalued the artist and turned them into an agent of capital flow, i.e. the super freelance graphic designer working for Local Potato Organics one week and Lockheed Martin the next, or the competitive, narcissistic maker of images created with a social media tag in mind. In this world, it may be a turn to the ancients to help provide a perspective on what the artist can or should do next. Things evolve, of course. Identities are fluid. Nature, with culture, will always surprise us and hopefully keep us alive. But through capital, through competition, through the vast effects of an unrepentant search for more, we have displaced ourselves often to ourselves' selves. In this multiple space, beyond the human, there is actually still opportunity for us to rekindle the connection to our creative, free, cosmopolitan collectivity. Not all is lost. In fact, all may soon be rediscovered. The title of this talk is Humans Are Horses, Artists Don't Have to Be, Humans Can Be Artists. I will explain this soon, but before then, I will strike an overview of this talk and why I am presenting it now. I planned to start it with a rendition of a terrifying piece of media I recently heard between Alan Jones and Mark Latham, but I don't want to give them any more airtime. Suffice to say, that generation of white men will soon be gone. I don't think they will carry on for much longer, and by the time they are gone, the fear they were drilling into the ears of their dear listeners of gender-fluid, non-binary, free-identifying individuals marrying each other and making children and blowing apart the nuclear family into the unclear family will actually have come true. And we can be at peace knowing that intense bigotry may be history, but not present. Okay, back to the topic at hand. This talk will argue one thing, but it will do so through a complex layering of multiple interconnected frameworks. The one thing it will argue for is that the future economy will be artist-led. The frameworks I will use to explain this are multiple, as there are many structures in the way of it happening. And for my argument to become effective, these need to be understood, dismantled, and repurposed. But first, I want to talk about a key concept inherent to almost everything we ever do, especially in art, especially in politics. Processes of relationality between and of me, you, and us. I have recently been absorbing some scientific literature, which is actually fairly rare for me, namely holographic and geometric research, which attempts to explain the micro and macro, internal and external, momentary and eternal shapes of life. In the theory of Nassim Haramein, the vacuum, life itself, is both absorbing and expressing simultaneously, effecting and affecting as one. This is true of the smallest thing in the universe and the largest galaxy out there. It is true of each of us. Your history, my present, our possibility, are connected in ways best expressed through the myriad creative expressions and impressions of our evolving intersubjectivity. What has drawn me to this theory are the ramifications of it to our idea of the one and the other. This idea of the simultaneity of all things is what initially propelled me into this body of work and research. I wanted to understand how much of my ancestry was present in this life. And now I want to be good at positively becoming with those around me, and those whom rely on me, and those whom I can benefit because of my privilege of birth. Sometimes, even in shapes, in metaphor, in new language, we find a way to see what has been clouded by misunderstanding or lack of sleep. It is this recent re-understanding of wholeness that I want to bring to the world through art as a political force. Humans always live in a weird time, but ours is especially weird. And we haven't always been horses. Deterritorialization is a concept used by Deleuze and Guattari to describe the schizophrenic, disconnected, fluid nature of human subjectivity brought upon by capitalism and globalization. It is a handy concept which goes a little deeper than displacement to explain some of the unseen effects of the modern world. But it also holds the affective truth of displacement brought upon by geopolitical war and environmental catastrophe. Whilst both of these reasons for flight and fragility are not new of our capitalist era, they have rampantly increased in severity and scale, and our awareness of and complicity in the despair of others dealing with such tragedy has never been more acute. There are currently over 60 million people in exodus, forced from their homelands due to unnecessary wars over the dregs of the nationalist system, itself the dag of colonialism, that has been moved into hypergear through profit-driven military and industrial coercion. A lot of these people are moving between Middle Eastern countries and via North Africa, mainly Libya, and into Europe via Greece and Sicily. My family emigrated out of Sicily in 1962. The township where they moved from is now the first point of detention for many exiting through Libya. Over 400,000 people landed in Sicily between 2015 and 2016. The camps, as well as the ships that smuggle, are often run by the mafia, taking it from both sides and controlling the flow of capital through flexible and adaptive networks. Imagine the terror of some of these people's journeys. Imagine eventually being imprisoned in a country like Australia after already spending 10 years away from family or having lost your family on the way. Imagine how that deterritorialized person would feel, knowing they are barred from a country that was stolen and who continue to uphold its national status as a place for pride amongst other great states. We know it does not need to be like this. Yet we allow it to continue, not because we don't care, but because we have no right to change it, no recourse to cease the violence. Our power is diminished by those who have worked very hard and for many years to grab it, keep it, and protect it from being eroded by those who wish to share a good life with their fellow citizens of the world. Our lack of action is also the result of generations of alienation. Alienation is a key factor used to disassociate populations from reality, which turn us into willing participants in a system that incarcerates or kills others who are deemed unworthy of the same rights we take for granted. This biopolitical power, now writ large from Michel Foucault's thesis via the brilliant Achille Mbembe, becomes a necropolitical force capable of easily deciding who will live and who will die. This force uses new technologies such as military drones and satellite operations out of transnational military zones like Pine Gap. These tools are paramount to the success of necropolitics, and our complicity in their use is a moral disaster. How are we complicit? Follow the money. Follow the trail from your Facebook account to Google's investments in weapons, to the State Department's backdoor to your private conversations, to Trump's winning via data metric manipulation by Cambridge Analytica, mining your likes, shares, comments, attitudes, positions, and consumer habits in a highly effective matrix of modern manipulation. The internet was never designed for this. The crypto anarchists that pioneered it have one hand holding their heads in shame and the other hand in jubilation that they bought Bitcoin when it was worth $30. Whilst the world is definitely getting weirder, it is also following the same grooves it has for a long time. The old oligarchs remain and new ones are born. These new rich folk may appear open and generous, and yes, their tools have assisted in the breakdown of despotic governments, but their motive is profit. They are engineered towards creating products to be consumed by masses of people with a massive return to their bottom line. Unfortunately, it is few and far between that we see these enterprises connecting in and empowering not-for-profit social enterprises whose mission is to make people's lives better. But it's not all doom and gloom. I would not be sitting here hoping to have you join me in this wild art ride unless I believed there was another way. One of the great things about future tech is all the talk around automation. It produces such fear and excitement in people that it is hard to know what we are actually hoping for. Do you want to keep driving in slow traffic, clogging up the atmosphere with fossil fuels? Do you want to sit in a pod that can attach and detach from a public transport module that shoots you to your front door? But how can you trust the driverless car? In case of imminent disaster, who will it kill? The cat? The granny? The toddler? Or the guy? How can you trust a human to make this decision? Anyway, these are not my questions of future tech. They interest me, but are far out of my knowledge base, and I am sure there are thousands of super smart people out there working out how to use a good drone to make me all I need without having to leave my computer. My interest in future tech is actually in AI and automation. Due to the effects AI and automation are having and will continue to have on industry and work, many specialists from science, politics, business, innovation, etc. are openly and seriously talking about an idea that has been around for centuries, but which has been refuted in each generation as immoral, impossible, or unsuitable. The only people not really talking about it are the ones who should be speaking the loudest about it. Artists. The reason why industry is currently so vocal is because of predictions such as 50% of the job market, current job market, will be replaced by machines in the following 10 years. Recently, a Q&A special on the future of work spoke a lot about retraining people to be computer engineers, software and UX designers, and that this is where humans will be needed in the future. But, and this is the reason why the idea has such traction now, the amount of jobs that will go will far exceed the amount of new ones being created. To quote entrepreneur Federico Pistone, these computer engineering jobs are highly specialist, and you cannot expect a 45-year-old ex-truck driver to compete against a Ukrainian whiz kid who invents four apps a day. What no one on Quanda panel spoke about is unconditional basic income. The concept of unconditional basic income, UBI, I will call it from here, will not be new to most of you here, but for the sake of clarity, I will summarise. UBI is an economic distribution model whereby every citizen, whether they are Gina Reinhart or me, is given a living wage. Regular contributions would be automatically transferred on a fortnightly or monthly basis, and you would never have it reduced for non-participation. True UBI does not require participation and incentive for people to receive it. Some capitalists who are pushing for it, partially because they think it will remove welfare and hence their tax rate, believe there need to be incentives attached to it, such as if you graduate from university or participate in an official work scheme. Such ideas actually go against the true free market capitalist ideals that these people adore, as it would necessitate not less, but more bureaucracy, re-government, and would inevitably lead to punishment and reward systems. And we know those don't work out so well. I mean, look at the daily toil of a homeless person on the streets of Melbourne who is not paid Centrelink, versus Corey Bernardi, who is rewarded every day by taxpayer dollars for upholding Australian bigotry. A true UBI would reward life itself and promote a sense of empowerment and freedom for all people to choose the type of work they do and how they are defined. And it is affordable. I can supply you with research done by groups such as BN, the Basic Income Earth Network, after this. But essentially, if you redistribute most current welfare subsidies and the bulk of the bureaucracy that serves them, put a price on carbon, reduce handouts to pollies, and remove negative gearing, it would be affordable in Australia to pay each adult citizen $600 per week, and then some. Schemes like the NDIS and parenting payments would not be greatly affected. In order for it to be truly effective, we would also need to put a cap on rental increases by landowners to stop the greedy just slapping an extra $600 per week on the price of their rental property. But look, what revolution has not involved land reform? There are many arguments against UBI. It is unaffordable, people are lazy, they won't work or do anything, they'll turn to crack and start eating their children, this kind of palaver. But the biggest concern people have, and the reason I am talking about it today, is this. People won't know what to do with themselves. Who will we be without work? The solution? Artists. Remember earlier I talked about humans being horses? Well, with the Industrial Revolution and Fordism and cars, 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 came the inevitable disuse of horses for transportation. In no other epoch have humans been fully replaced by machines. There has always been something for the human to do in servicing or maintenance, and new industries have formed over the last century due to globalization. But as I pointed out before, AI and machine learning will make most of what we might do to help the machines redundant. The machines themselves will help themselves, and only some specialists will be required to tweak design, and the rest of the population, if they aren't in fucking marketing, will become as useful as horses were to the early 20th century workforce. Artists don't have to be horses. Even when there is no paid work or useful productive job to do, the artist remains busy. Artists continue operating outside the cycle of 9 to 5, now 9 to 6, and some seem never to stop working. Why is this? The value that the artist brings to the world is beyond any widget. The work of the artist is to breathe the soul of nature with humankind. And they sometimes make fun and cool shit, and sometimes it's really hard to deal with, and other times it just makes you go, yep, I'm really glad Maurizio Catalan revealed a massive middle finger salute in front of the fascist-era Italian Stock Exchange Borsa building in Milano. And that even though the financiers complained and wanted it removed, the Milanese people rallied the government to keep it secure, to remind them that the financial elite have no respect for them. In this weird new world, in a hypothetical world without work, people will certainly have more time to care for their families and friends, to volunteer and be involved in social reformation projects. Further, they would have the opportunity to get in touch with the creative inner child whom has probably lain dormant since they were sent to a real estate agency for work experience as a teenager. In this weird world, the artist will be an invaluable commodity. They will be sought out for their mastery of stretching and truncating time, for their ability to conceive of the impossible and bring it into form, for their psychological ballet between their own memories and the stories of others, and for their unwavering passion to the pursuit of the ridiculous, the sublimely beautiful, and the absolutely necessary. For these speak directly to our souls, to our understanding, or lack of it, of our lives together. So, humans can be artists. In this artist-led future, in a space and time when we have what we need to survive and thrive, we will need to conceive of ways that we work together across identity divides. To start with, a UBI would need to be disseminated nationally. But there's no reason why we shouldn't couple its distribution with the extraordinary capacity of blockchain technology and cryptocurrency. Whilst our economic systems are becoming planetary, it is time the public worked on imagining how we could become truly open and interconnected across political borders. This public imaginary toward a cosmopolitan future should look more like the cynic or stoic vision and less like the semi-Kantian model we have today. Immanuel Kant believed that we should build a cosmopolitan society as a rational extension of the structures of the nation state and through a moral obligation to every citizen of the world. The Greeks thought the world citizen, or more accurately, the citizen of the cosmos, should together design a world that promotes equality, equanimity, free speech and virtue, without borders, without need to define mine from yours, without land ownership, but from and with a sense of love and care to those whom you share life with. Of course, this truly cosmopolitan world would require all the ingenuity, hard work, politicking, organising that is key to human endurance. But it would be done with a sense of cooperation and creative imagineering. In a world where your basic survival is taken care of, there would be no need to compete just to live. You could choose to compete if you wanted more, or you could choose to stop being a horse and get back on the horse and ride it into your own fantastic future. Thank you.